This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to the EU After Brexit, a special hour-long programme combining Radio 4's The Bottom Line and The Briefing Room. We're examining the economic and political future of the EU once Britain has left in exactly a year's time. Just what is the new vision for Europe?
Hello and welcome to this special programme in which The Briefing Room and The Bottom Line, the regular occupants of the 8 o'clock Thursday slot, have come together in analytical harmony at a significant moment.
It's 365 days and 3 hours to Brexit, give or take any leap seconds and the odd minute or two. You'll hear some familiar elements of both our programmes in this hour, but we've combined forces on one main theme.
Which is that we British often discuss Brexit as though it was all about us, but it isn't. The European Union will still be there after March the 29th, 2019, and will still be hugely important to us. So for this hour, we'll be talking about them. How people in the EU think the Union might develop with the UK not there. Our absence will make a difference. The UK is almost 13% of the EU population. We put money in, shaped vital policies like the liberal single market and the enlargement of the Union, and resisted others like greater integration.
So what effect will our absence have? And regardless of Brexit, the EU faces some pretty big decisions. It's in the middle of a debate about how to reform the working of the euro. Should it integrate more, create a political union to supplement the currency union, or should it slow down the drive towards federalism? And how should it cope with the pressures of populism, a major electoral force in many EU countries, and one that often comes with a Eurosceptic slant?
In a few minutes, I'll be looking at the political vision for the EU once Britain has left. Do President Macron's calls for deeper political integration stand any chance of being heeded? We'll also be getting the views of three business people from the continent. How do they see the economy progressing?
But first, let's spend a few minutes hearing from one of the most senior voices in Europe, Jean-Claude Trichet. Now, he's played a huge role in shaping the modern EU over two decades. He was at the French Treasury when the Maastricht Treaty was signed, setting the continent on the path to the euro. He was governor of the French Central Bank in the 90s as the euro got going. And he was president of the European Central Bank for 8 years, including during some of the worst years of the financial crisis. Today, he's chairman of a prestigious Brussels-based think tank, Bruegel. He tends to relatively conservative economic thought. He worries about too much public spending and debt, but is above all a committed European. A more establishment perspective from the EU you will not find. He is taking pride in the fact the Eurozone has survived its great crisis and the economy there is now growing at a reasonably comfortable pace. So earlier this week, I went to meet him in Paris to ask how he sees the Eurozone and EU developing. First, I asked him whether he thinks the euro is now a stable piece of the international currency architecture.
Well, first of all, I would say that we had a difficult period which was associated with not only the financial crisis, which started in the United States of America and spread everywhere, but also because we had our own crisis, which was the sovereign risk crisis. And that, of course, put, I would say, approximately 35, 37, 40% of the euro area GDP in a situation of sudden stop of financing. So it had an impact on the real economy. Those countries had lost creditworthiness, and they had to regain their creditworthiness. And I have to say, we are now in a period where creditworthiness has been regained very largely, and real growth is there since several years. You might not know that because it was not advertised very much, But growth in the euro area in 16 was superior to growth in the United States of America. We posted 1.8% growth and the US 1.5.
And even Greece is growing now. And Greece has had a year of growth, which
and last year also we grew quite well, 2.5%. And the United States of America, 2.4. So two successive years, growth is there. So it is there because the countries that were in difficulty are now back, as you just said.
You will know, though, that there are one or two potential crises. And one has to look at Italy, a country that people say is too big to save and too big to fail for the Eurozone, where it starts with a pretty difficult fiscal background, and where you have an election where the people who dominated the election are the people who are saying we're fed up with austerity, the government should be spending a lot more. Now, is that the next shock? Is that something that you lose sleep over?
Italy is one of the countries where hard work has to be done. That's absolutely clear. And the Commission was very clear on that very recently, singling out Italy and Greece and some other countries as having a lot of homework to do in structural reforms. A lot of surpluses of the north of Italy is wasted in the south of Italy. So management of the country as a whole is a very, very important issue, which has to be improved. And of course, you have the legacy of the past with a level of public debt outstanding, which is very elevated.
You're coming across as very optimistic about the euro. Are you satisfied that with the growth that is, everybody agrees, is better than expected and the eurozone is comfortably progressing, that this is the time to do the difficult homework, as you refer to it? They've got to do it now because you can't wait for the next recession to do that.
Fully agree. The metaphor, you know, it is when there is a sunny weather that you repair the roof. One of my problems when I was president of the ECB was that the most important countries in Europe were saying we don't apply the Stability and Growth Pact. We do not want to recognize that we have a lot of rules that we should respect. So, of course, the lessons that were drawn from the crisis, the wake-up call of the crisis, has been, from that standpoint, very useful, if I may. But it has been very, very heavy cost to be paid.
But look, reform is on the agenda for the eurozone. Macron has his proposals, the European Commission has proposals. The basic choice is you integrate more in order to make it work better. You maybe have a finance minister and a budget for the eurozone. Maybe you have some of the stronger countries making guarantees that will ultimately protect some of the weaker countries. Do you believe in that agenda?
First of all, I was the first to call for a finance minister of the euro area, which might be a little bit paradoxical for a central banker. But I think that it's wrong to think that the European would have a system whereby they would pool the totality of their budget.
Right, this is the crucial one.
Does not exist in the US. There is no pool. No.
You're not even going to get to where the US is in the eurozone.
But it does not exist in the US. It does not exist in Canada. It does not exist in Switzerland. It doesn't exist in Germany. So in the federal state, you don't have one single signature. So I have to say that from time to time, I hear things that do not fit exactly with our own, you know, very special...
No, but I can't let you get away with that. Would you envisage that the Germans will extend greater guarantees over the borrowing of some of the southern countries over the next 10 or 15 years?
In my opinion, it is not the way things are going. You know, when five countries out of the 15, because it's a minority of countries, had problems in the crisis, as you know, we created a fund to help them. And that fund was financed by all others, not by Germany alone, by all others. You can imagine a number of possibilities, but not considering that all the debt of country X would be guaranteed by all others. Okay. It's not only a problem of Germany, it's a problem of all taxpayers in Europe. They cannot imagine to take the risk of others without having the capacity to control others. So it's really a matter of common sense in a way.
Something you're saying that's very interesting is maybe a Eurozone finance minister, maybe more integration in some respects. I just look around at what's happening in European elections and you see very Eurosceptic parties doing very well, even in France here, they did pretty well in that first round. I mean, they didn't get through in the second round. But everywhere...
That is true.
You see the scepticism. Now, how do you respond to that scepticism? Because you're sounding like one of these great Brussels technocrats who says the way to respond to the public voting against it all is to pursue it a little bit faster and a little bit more ruthlessly, and then the public will have to just fit in with our vision rather than us fitting in with theirs.
If I may, Ivan, it is true to a limit. It is true that we have, in all advanced economy, and evidently in continental Europe and in Ireland too, we have populism. We have a wave of nationalism, protectionism, and populism. That wave exists, of course, in continental Europe. But the big mistake which is made by some observers is to consider that wave is anti-European, anti-euro. And it is not true. The euro has never been so popular in continental
Europe. But the five-star movement Italy was at
precisely
one point saying,
sir,
was saying they're going to come out.
You give me the best argument for me. Five stars decided before the election that they would not ask for leaving the euro, that they would not ask for leaving the European Union, and that the reason why they had a very good result, because they could see what happened in France. Leaving the euro proved catastrophic in terms of
popular
support.
But populism has a very powerful force on the continent at the moment, and it must provide a huge challenge to the kind of the European establishment. Has it made you think at all about how you structure the vision of the European Union?
No.
Has it made you question anything about...
No, I fully agree with you, of course. We have exactly the same frustration of our population associated with the rise of India, China, the emerging world, which creates a call for restructuring our productive sector. We neglected that it would have a big, big bearing on... part of our middle class, or the lower middle class, the less educated part of our population, and we should have devoted much more energy to that particular problems of frustration of a large part of our population. It's the most important political problem that we all have to cope with, but could be solved through cooperation, intimate cooperation. If you are speaking of trade, then you better negotiate trade with 27 countries than alone.
Look, let me ask what effect, because we're not talking Brexit, but we're talking about the EU.
Yeah.
What effect does Britain leaving the EU have on the remaining EU? It feels as though the British have been on your side, your personal side, of the economic argument. They tend to take a more market view, they support structural reform and tend to be a little bit more fiscally conservative. Is the European Union going to change when the British aren't there arguing for all of that?
I would say it's more than that. I mean, I consider the UK as the sanctuary of market economy, the sanctuary of freedom and liberty, the inventor of representative democracy. It's a loss in terms of values, in my opinion. It's not a loss taking into account the dimension of the UK and the dimension of the European Union. It is not something that will hurt us in terms of growth and so forth. In the present period, we see to which extent we are growing faster than the UK. One of the arguments before was we are growing faster than the European Union and so forth.
Yeah.
So I think these arguments are not the real ones. The real ones are in terms of value and in terms of obvious convergence of interest, strategic, geostrategic, not only economic, geostrategic interest. So... it's a pity.
Jean-Claude Trichet, thank you so much for talking
thank
to
you.
Me. Thank you.
So much for the economics. Now let's talk about the new politics of a Britainless EU. We asked the BBC's Brussels correspondent, Adam Fleming, for an introduction to the attitudes of the main players.
Emmanuel Macron laid out his vision for a reformed EU in an epically long speech at the Sorbonne last year. It included all sorts of proposals, from making sure that every EU teenager could speak two languages to having an EU Defence Intelligence Academy. But lots of his proposals were about reforming the Eurozone. He wants a budget for the Eurozone that would raise money and then spend it in Eurozone countries. He wants a Eurozone finance minister and even a parliament to represent the Eurozone. So he's got a massive vision, particularly for economic and monetary union. Macron thinks that the world needs the EU and its values and its way of doing things. He also thinks the EU is an amazing way for the individual member countries to protect themselves. He also thinks he has got a cast iron mandate to do all of this because this is the platform he ran on in the election and hoovered up loads of votes as being unashamedly pro-EU and pro-reforming the EU. Angela Merkel is quite suspicious of some of Emmanuel Macron's big ideas, especially for the Eurozone. Her big worry is about something called a transfer union. In other words, a big redistribution of money from richer countries in the EU in the event of a crisis. She would like countries to stick to the rules that exist now, although she could be convinced on the idea of a European Monetary Fund, which could raise and spend money across the EU in a bigger way than happens now. Although a lot of the focus on Germany is actually in the shorter term, because we're about to have a big debate about the MFF, the multi-annual financial framework, which is the seven-year budget cycle, which will kick in from 2021 after the UK is well gone and left the EU. And that's about to be a big political debate about its priorities and how it works. Then we come to the Visegrad group, who are often portrayed as the troublemakers. That's the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Poland, and Hungary. The last two in particular have been really chafing against the constraints of the EU. Poland making some big changes to its judiciary, which are very unpopular in Brussels and have triggered the first ever use of the EU's internal discipline procedure. And Viktor Orban of Hungary, who delivers the kind of anti-Brussels propaganda to every single Hungarian household in leaflet form that would even make a British Brexiteer blush. However, they want the good stuff from the EU. For example, on everyday things like product standards. A big debate last year was whether Eastern European countries got lower quality chocolate and ready meals just because they were in the East rather than being in the West. Although they could have to face the music soon, because there's a big discussion in Brussels at the moment about whether the next budget cycle from 2021 should link EU funds to sticking to the EU rules and behaving well. Then there's a group of countries that will miss Britain and the role it has played for being pragmatic, businesslike, and focusing on what the EU does well, but just doing it better. The person who's taking on that mantle is the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte. And recently, his finance minister was joined by the finance ministers of Finland, Denmark, Sweden, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Ireland to say, let's hold our horses on all these big reforms to the Eurozone. Do we really need to be ambitious? Couldn't countries just stick to the rules that exist now? And there was a really good example the other day when the European Commission proposed a new way of taxing digital companies, taxing what they do online rather than their profits. And some countries like the Netherlands, Ireland, and Luxembourg said no thank you, because they jealously want to guard individual member states' rights when it comes to things like taxation.
Adam Fleming. In the first instance, as Adam just said, the biggest test of the Macron strategy will come in Berlin. Daniela Schwarzer is director of the German Council on Foreign Relations, and she's in a studio in, appropriately, Paris. Daniela Schwarzer, Macron, in his speech to the Sorbonne last autumn, used this memorable phrase, the Europe we know is too slow, too weak, too ineffective. Does Germany share that opinion?
The German establishment pretty much shares the view that the EU needs to be reformed. In particular, in times of Brexit, the EU has to prove that it's worthwhile maintaining and it needs to be developed further. And policymakers in Berlin are generally very happy to see a leader in Paris who actually wants to take things forward in Europe. However, obviously we on our side in Germany had some trouble in getting our own government into place. So Paris had to wait for a while, and now slowly Germany is formulating its answer.
So, by and large, you think the German politicians agree with Macron's analysis, governmental politicians do, and you think that now that the coalition government has been formed, they can give some kind of practical expression to that?
Yes, and they already have done so. The government works on the basis of what we call a coalition treaty, which is a pretty long document. And it actually starts out with a chapter on the future of Europe. That shows you how important this whole topic is seen. Whenever I talk to policymakers in Berlin, people are very aware that the EU is under tension and that there are forces driving the EU apart, and that it is in Germany's core interest to actually bring the EU forward in order to maintain it as a group of 27 member states and a single market and a currency union. And the address where Berlin will first turn to is really Paris.
Does that mean that Germany largely subscribes to the idea that greater integration within the EU is the way to travel?
Indeed it does, though there are differences to the view in Paris. First of all, we are facing a situation in the EU at the moment where we have two unfinished fields of integration. One is the Eurozone, where we are pretty sure that if another crisis hits, we won't be totally resilient. So there needs to be some additions in terms of banking union, in terms of fiscal dimension, and also in terms of economic policy coordination. France and Germany don't agree on all the bits and pieces, but they share the view that more needs to be done. And the other areas, the Schengen area, so basically the area for justice and home affairs, we have drawn down borders and we haven't done enough to protect citizens to worry about our external borders, so for the whole of the EU. And that's the other area where unfinished integration actually creates a popular backlash, where people are unsatisfied. They feel threatened. They feel they are not governed properly. And then in addition to that, defense, because of the changes in the transatlantic relationship, Europe gets more attention on the issue of defense. And so Germany does agree we need to move forward. Then when it comes to details, there will be different views in Paris and in Berlin, but that's pretty natural for the Franco-German relationship, that you start out from different positions and then there are long negotiations and finally a compromise.
Daniela, suppose the Macron plan doesn't get any traction or the French don't go through with it. What do you think then would be the consequences?
Europe would move forward in certain policy areas, possibly with smaller group of countries. So a more differentiated and more complex picture would emerge, maybe less transparent than the EU is today. But I don't think that Europe would simply not move ahead at all. The big challenge for France and Germany is not only to forge their own bilateral compromise, but really to bring others in very early and, you know, not table a joint view of where Europe should go, but start as of now to bring in Central and Eastern Europeans, to bring in the Nordic countries, to talk to the other Mediterranean countries, because Europe no longer functions that way, that France and Germany hammer out a compromise and then take the others along. There has already been a letter of 8 smaller countries, and that's the new dividing line which adds to the north and south and east and west. It's the small and large country line, a letter where they speak about their reservations of a possible Franco-German compromise on deepening the Eurozone. So you can see that there are lots of sensitivities, and this is something that Germany is traditionally more inclined to see and more inclined to invest political capital into. So I think that will be part of Berlin's role to take Paris along and make the French talk to the Central and Eastern Europeans and really bring them into a broader EU-wide debate.
Daniela Schwarzer, who, as you just heard, talked about the importance for the Macron plan of a dialogue with the more recently acceded countries of Eastern and Central Europe, like Poland. Justyna Zając is a professor of history and international relations at the University of Warsaw and speaks to us from there. Justyna Zając, what does Poland think about Emmanuel Macron's plan for economic and political integration?
Well, actually, Poland is not in favor of this plan because Macron plans consider and focuses a lot for the Eurozone. And he proposed to create like a finance minister, for example, on the Eurozone budget. So Poland is not in favor of this project because actually Poland is not part of the Eurozone. And this government is not going to accept euro in the near future. And it's clearly stated from the ministry and from the prime minister of Poland, Mateusz Morawiecki, that the project of Macron is to create like two-speed Europe. And Poland always said that it's against of this two-speed Europe because it would mean marginalize of the Central Europe, including Poland. In fact, for Poland, what is important about the European Union is that is always underlined that the EU is economic project. It means that it's very important, the single market and this four freedoms, the free movement of goods, the free movement of capital, on services and people.
Does the Polish government believe that there should be, however, greater integration within the European Union as a whole, including the Eurozone and the non-Eurozone?
Actually, not, because this is a more complicated issue. From Poland and Polish government and the ruling party, it's very important to keep sovereignty of the states. So this what the government underline is to keep and rather to strengthen the intergovernmental institutions within the European Union rather than to give more power to the institutions like European Commission.
So what does Poland think about, for example, integrated border security with, let's say, a uniformed European Union force at the outer borders of the European Union? Would they be against that?
I'm not sure whether the government has got a clear position on this issue. But, for example, when we talk about the security and in the context, for example, of immigration, that is a very important issue, I guess, the immigration crisis. So the government believed that the immigration policy, asylum policy, it should stay in hands of Polish state.
What about the problems of the European perception of the domestic policies of the Polish government, particularly the politicisation of the courts and the media? How does the Polish government see itself resolving these issues in terms of its relationship with the European Union?
This is another problematic issue because the European Commission in December last year, December 2017, decided to launch this Article 7 of the Treaty of the European Union against Poland, and it was because of a violation of rule of law by Poland, and it was referring to this reform of judiciary in Poland. So there were talks in last weeks between the European Commission and between the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Poland, and they are still in talks, but the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Jacek Czaputowicz, he stated very clearly that Poland keeps this reform and is not going to change anything because this reform is right and it is not against of values of the European Union. So my prediction is that it will be another problematic issue between the European Commission and Poland, as well as, for example, the migration crisis that is also problematic between those two sides.
Some of those things you've talked about, Poland has in common with what they call the other Visegrad countries, Hungary, Czech Republic and Slovakia. Is there a kind of unity between those countries about how to deal with inside the European Union, or are they more different than we realise?
I would say that those Visegrad countries, they don't have common strategies in face of the European Union. This what they have the same goal, for example, like with immigration crisis. But I just don't see that they really have the same long-term interest vis-a-vis European Union. So I believe that the Visegrad countries, they can have the common tactics, but not the common strategy vis-a-vis the European Union, because the long-term interests are different.
Justyna Zając. So it sounds like the Poles will take a lot of persuading. But even more critical will be the positions of the group of eight smaller countries of the EU, mostly the Scandinavians and Northern Europeans. Down the line from The Hague, I'm joined by Jeroen Dijsselbloem, who was Dutch finance minister for 5 years until last autumn. Jeroen Dijsselbloem, we've heard Jean-Claude Trichet supporting measures for integration, including a European finance minister. Does that appeal to the Dutch?
No, not really, because I think it's become a huge symbol of deeper integration. But what is a finance minister without sufficient mandate, without budget, etc.? And I think it doesn't help for the real weaknesses in the Eurozone.
Which, according to the Netherlands, are what?
The weakest point still in the monetary union is our dependency on banks, our lack of a well and truly deep developed capital markets. So rather on the market side and the private economy side than on the public economy side. And we're trying to fix it and trying to set up pots of money and budgets on the public side to cover our risks on the private side. And I don't think that's the right approach.
Now, the Macron vision, as it was laid out in the autumn, was not obviously just about money. It was also essentially about the whole of the European project and its need for greater integration and for greater energy. And what he effectively said was, unless we do this, then in that case we run prey to populism and we lose our sense of mission. Is there anything about that which resonates with you?
I think that he made a very strong point on the issue of security, safety, migration, outside borders. All of those topics are even higher on the priority list of our peoples in all of our countries than the economy at the moment. And it's interesting to see if you read the speeches of Macron, he actually puts more emphasis on those topics than on the, let's say, the Minister of Finance for the Eurozone.
The headline on what you're saying is that the economic aspects of Macron's integration vision are less important and less significant than the other ones, than the ones for security and borders.
I think politically that is the case. Also from his perspective, he puts more emphasis on security-related issues. Within the economic issues, he has the right priorities because both President Macron and his finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, put all the emphasis on let's finish the banking union, let's create that capital markets union, let's make our economies more competitive, let's raise investments. And those are the right priorities. And they see the other topics, the Minister of Finance and the Eurozone budget, much more for the future, further down the line.
So in a sense, insofar as the Macron vision went beyond matters of security, he hasn't yet persuaded countries like the Netherlands of the viability or the need to go there.
Well, there is a very consistent French thinking about the monetary union and that it requires a political union and therefore a Minister of Finance and a Eurozone budget. But it doesn't address the lack of competitiveness in our economies. It doesn't involve the private economy. It doesn't look at the issue of why should so many private risks in our economy be buffered by public money. This is what happened in the Eurozone crisis. And having a finance minister, it's become a symbol. And our priorities should be to get those really strong banking sector to fund our economy and to diversify the funding of our economy.
Now, looking at this question of security, one of the things that's come out is the idea that the European Union itself should have its own border force, uniform border force, European Union border force, operating at the outer borders of the European Union. Is that something that the Netherlands would support?
I think it's crucial. We have built the European Union with some big, brave steps in the past, and one of which was creating the Schengen zone, which has no longer internal border controls. But if you do that, you must establish outside border controls. You cannot take away inside borders without establishing and protecting the joint outside border. We have a joint interest to protect the outside border. We cannot ask and depend on Greece to do it on its own. We cannot leave the Italians to deal with that on their own. So it is a joint responsibility. and let's get rid of the taboo that there is on having a European agency with European uniforms.
Does that mean that Brussels should have more power when it comes to policing the borders of the EU and security matters?
I think this is a clear example where doing it really jointly, supranational, if you want, under the control of the Commission and democratically supervised by the European Parliament, I think this is a very strong example.
You've seen the rise of populism in the Netherlands and in other EU countries. It's one of the things that the Macron vision was designed to address. How do you think the European Union should deal with the democratic deficit that's perceived between the governed and the ruling class in Europe?
Most of our voters are not as concerned about the democratic legitimacy, which is rather an abstract discussion. They are very much concerned about two key issues in their lives. One is security, and the other one is prosperity, or the perspective of prosperity. And for a very long time, the EU contributed to both, and it was undisputed. And both have been hampered badly in the last 10 years, due, of course, to the crisis, which started as a financial crisis and became a debt crisis in the Eurozone. And secondly, the migration. And in both cases, we entered into a big project with lots of ambitions, but didn't get it right. We didn't set it up in a solid way. We entered into the monetary union, but didn't complete it with having bank supervision jointly and strict rules for banks, etc. We entered into the Schengen zone without establishing the outside border control jointly. So on both fronts, we need to do better and deliver for our voters.
Jeroen Dijsselbloem, thank you very much indeed.
Okay, well, a lot to digest there, institutional and political. But frankly, we know you can sit down and try to design the European political project for as long as you want, but to make it fly, the economics and business side has to flourish. So let's now take a look at where the EU is going in economic terms as a place to do business. In some Brexit minds here in the UK, by being a member of the EU, the UK is shackled to a corpse, to use a rather unpleasant metaphor. The argument goes that the EU is a shrinking proportion of the world economy and is ill-adapted to adjust to changing conditions. So do my guests agree? For the rest of the hour, I'm joined by three European business leaders from very different backgrounds to hear their views. And first of all, joining us down the line from Rome is Lorenzo Bini-Smaghi, who's chair of the French bank Société Générale. I call it a French bank, Lorenzo, but you have branches all over Europe.
Yes, especially in Eastern Europe, but also in Africa. And we are a global bank, investment bank, with branch in the US, in Japan, Asia, and so forth.
Okay, so an international bank with French base. And
London.
And London, of course.
Of course.
And we might come to talk about yes. financial services. You were also actually on the executive board of the European Central Bank, which must have given you some insight to how yes. things work at that level.
Yes, from 2005 to 2011.
Just in a nutshell, how is business going at Société Générale at the moment?
The European economy is doing well, so banking is improving. We have a lot of regulation to adjust to. And, of course, we are competing with the U.S. banks all over the world. That's one of the main challenges.
Okay. Let me introduce my second guest, Matt Regan, Senior Vice President and Head of Europe for Danish pharmaceutical company Novo Nordisk. Matt, it's primarily diabetes-focused drugs is where you make your money, correct?
Well, we're a global pharmaceutical company, Evan, and we've obviously domiciled in Europe, in Denmark. And we're on a mission to defeat diabetes and other chronic illnesses.
And people will hear from your accent that you originally, in fact, were from Republic of Ireland.
That's correct, Evan. I'm from the west of Ireland, County yeah. Mayo.
I was surprised in preparing for this programme, Novo Nordisk, its market capitalisation, the value of its shares, it's like $100 billion or something. This is a pretty big global pharmaceutical player. My third guest is Teofil Murasan. Now, he is chair of Electro Group Infrastructure, which is a telecoms and energy infrastructure company based in Bucharest in Romania. And you, in fact, created this company yourself, Teo.
Yes, tomorrow will be 21 years. It will have an anniversary when I founded the company. From the scratch, from the zero.
How big is it now?
Now it's a company with more than 100 million euros at turnover and an EBITDA of 20 million euro, consolidated figures, with 500 employees and more than 300 engineers.
Right, so tell us what you do, because for an infrastructure company, 500 employees is obviously very small. So yes. so what are you focusing on?
We are a builder in infrastructure, telecom, energy, civil works, renewables, but also the second vertical is to invest in infrastructures. We have our own infrastructures in telecom, fiber optical networks covering Romania and Bucharest. And we continue to invest in, of course, small infrastructure, but in so-called cross-sector, where two or more industries have something in common.
Okay. And is it just in Romania, or you're spread around a bit, I think, aren't you?
Started 3 years ago, we opened subsidiaries in Poland, Germany, Belgium, and we started also with a subsidiary in UK, which now is on standby.
Okay. Now, listen, gentlemen, we've had our debate here about the EU and its merits and its disadvantages. I want you to tell me what you like about it or what you don't like about it. Lorenzo, why don't you start with the financial services background?
Well, I like to be in the EU because, well, it's simpler. We have same rules throughout Europe, same regulation, the same supervisor. So things have improved enormously over the last few years. And now, unfortunately, we are going to have what I don't like is that somebody is getting out and it's making my life more complicated because we have to deal with different rules from now on.
Well, you're banned from talking about Brexit, Lorenzo, because we're trying to get away from Brexit. Matt, come on, what do you like about the EU? We've heard it makes it simpler because obviously it's a smaller number of rules across jurisdictions. What about you?
Yeah, I think certainly in the pharmaceutical industry, it has definitely been a force for good. You know, we have cooperation across the EU on the regulation of medicines. Obviously, free trade and being able to move across borders without restrictions, that has been hugely positive.
You mean people or the goods?
Goods and services, but also people was going to be my third one, Evan, because again, in a global pharmaceutical market, it's very important to have access to the very best talent. So the movement and access to talent. And I would say just having a predictable environment is extremely important in our industry where you've got very long cycle times, very long development cycles. So that predictability has definitely been a tremendous force for good in our market.
Come on, Teo. Now, I had a Romanian taxi driver the other day who was telling me everybody in Romania hates the EU. And but I'm guessing a lot of the business people don't.
I clearly say I like being in EU. EU can offer us a bigger market, opportunities to expand our services in other markets. After we worked for many years with the last technologies in Romania, we can apply. We are working for big companies, multinational companies in Romania, using the same technology. Now we can expand in other markets.
You're all three of you are positive about, none of you who've said I don't like being in the EU. What I find quite interesting is, in this country, we hear two different competing versions of what the EU is. One says it's a club run for big business. The other one says the EU is creaking, it's bureaucratic, it's inflexible, and gets in the way of business. Lorenzo, which of those would come closer, do you think, to the truth?
You know, in all countries, you have the bureaucracy because you need rules. You often hear people complaining and using as an example the fact that in Europe you regulate about everything. For instance, the size of cucumbers or the size of bananas. And then I was so struck about this that I wanted to look and Google EU regulation cucumber. And indeed, you have a regulation which establishes the size of cucumbers and the shape and everything. And then I asked myself, can this be really unique to the EU? So I Googled US regulation cucumber, and you have a regulation on cucumbers, which is even more detailed. So it's true. I think it's true that we have a lot of regulations, but I think it's part of a market, of a single market, which has to defend producers and consumers. You know, if you want to have a level playing field, you need this regulation.
But can I just ask any of you, we hear this word, these words, single market, all the time. Most British people probably now know the single market is really a kind of collection of harmonised regulations. It's not about customs procedures as much as harmonising the regulations so we're not blocking each other's trade with different rules. Do any of you really think of Europe as a single market, or do you still think there's Germany, France, Italy, Romania? I mean, how do you, in your thinking about Europe, do you think of it as a series of countries or as a single market? Lorenzo.
Well, I think it depends a lot on the sector. But certainly, if I think about banking, a mortgage in Italy is different from a mortgage in the Netherlands, is different from a mortgage in Romania. So you have national regulation and legislation on top of the European level playing field. So Europe tries to have a level playing field, but there are still differences of culture, of tradition, and of civil law also in particular. So it's a process, I would say. It has started, it's going on, and I think it's gone, you know, harmonization is going to take some time.
So it's a process, not a thing, Ter.
I'd like to highlight something why EU need fiscal integration. Right now, it seems like there are two Europes in one. The north of Europe, where the efficiency, technology, productivity is the main focus, and south of Europe, where agriculture, hotels, tourism, it's the main focus. So productivity in the south is just a fraction of the productivity in the north. So we really need to have a fiscal integration and more integration in general in Europe so that can compete as an entire market. Right.
What I would say is that you need the possibility to compete. If I think about comparing to the US, you would find that, you know, probably Florida compared to Massachusetts is more attractive in terms of tourism and agriculture also, but they live in the same environment, in the same monetary environment, the financial environment, and political environment, of course. And if there is a shock in Florida, probably a mechanism of transfers from the north to the south or from the south to the north that avoid a crisis making the thing explode. And that's what we're missing. I think that's what Theo was probably mentioning. Yeah. Maybe not something like Italy, but something that is reducing the centrifugal forces in case of a crisis.
Yeah, Evan, maybe if I could just come in here. For me, Europe is still a series of single countries with their own culture, their own history, in many cases, their own language. I've been fortunate enough to live in seven different countries. And, you know, people are all proud of their own background. But I think when it comes to the regulation of medicines, for example, the European Union has brought tremendous benefits because now you get a single license through the European Medicines Agency. And that speeds up access for patients because once you have a great innovation, you can go through one regulator and then you have regulatory approval. And then it becomes a discussion then with the individual countries.
But do you all want it to go further? Do you want more integration, a more level playing field, more harmonisation of rules or mutual recognition of each other's ways of doing things, Theo?
Yeah, I think for countries like Romania, countries from East Europe, it was a very good point to have a European regulation. So I can see the regulation is not bad, but Europe is overburdened by regulation. And in this period of time, we need speed. We need to move faster in competition with other countries, with other regions, with other continents.
The one area that it feels like Europe has made enormous strides, where it's been very dynamic, and is actually, Theo, in Eastern Central Europe. Because when we think of how poor those countries were when they came in, 14 years ago, and your country came in a bit less than 14 years ago, when you think of how poor they were, how completely cut off they were from Western supply chains, Western technology. I mean, it's been a pretty remarkable story as to progress. Maybe Romania, not as much as Poland and Czech Republic, I don't know.
Yes, but in a way it could be explained because Poland, Czech Republic, Hungary entered in EU in years before Romania. But of course, it's a huge opportunity for a country like Romania, you know, to get education, know-how, markets almost overnight. Even for me, you can imagine, I started to learn English 8 years ago, and it was, I think, first time when I visited a foreign country 10 years ago.
The first time you visited a foreign country?
Yes, exactly.
That's remarkable, isn't it? How old are you now, by the way?
52. Yeah. But what I want to stress is, in countries like Romania, where EU want to implement different projects, they look at the beginning. They said, you really need this project. At the end of the process, that is not good. And between beginning and the end, a lot of milestones, mm-hmm. lot of processes, as Lorenzo mentioned. I think this is the key. We really need to be helped with this kind of milestone and processes.
Sorry, so give me an example of the point you're making there.
For example, the building motorways in Romania, because there is a big, big problem in this. Okay, we can find, or government can find money from different institutions and to organize then everything and deliver the motorways. And even after 10 years or 20 years, the motorways are in the same stage because there are not controlled milestones during the process. Some of the thing, it's not because of the corruption, because of the lack of expertise.
Many people say the EU is history. It's the old world. And where businesses should be looking is the newer markets, the Indias and Chinas, which are growing at much faster rates. The emerging markets, even the United States, is growing faster. And I just wonder whether there's anything in that argument.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, Evan. I mean, if I look at our business, Europe is still almost 20% of our business. And yes, there are other parts of the world that are growing. Certainly China, India, for sure, are very important businesses for us as well. But also the sophistication of the healthcare system is much more developed as well within Europe. So I think it is very important for innovation-driven companies that they are heavily focused in Europe and in the US.
Lorenzo?
Take China. Certainly China is going to grow and is a much more interesting market than Europe. So the point is, how do we do business with China? In order to do business with China, we have to sit down at the table and discuss with them. I give you this, you give me that. And the point is that I think it's better to be at a table representing 500 million people, European, with the biggest market in the world, and negotiate, you know, with some assets on your side against the Chinese or against the Americans, than having much smaller markets.
Right.
What we don't have is still yet we don't have a fully integrated European capital market, and that's where we need to work, because that's where size. First, you get size at home. And then you become competitive and you go abroad.
Well, let's ask, is Brexit going to make a difference, not to Britain, to the rest of the EU? What effect, what hole does the UK leave? Teo, come on, do you think it makes a difference if the UK leave?
You know, depends of what kind of Brexit will be. Will be a soft Brexit or will be a hard Brexit. In any trading, historically, in any trade, if a part go away, we'll hurt both.
Matt?
I think the UK was always a very valuable and sensible voice in the debate within Europe. And what I'm picking up more and more, and this is from cabinet ministers as well that I've spoken to all across Europe, is that Europeans want a sensible agreement with the UK insofar as we can maintain as much of the status quo as possible around trade, around people, talent, and also predictability as well.
Lorenzo, what's your take? What does the Britain leaving, what hole does it leave? I mean, obviously, you're a big player in London and in the financial services sector generally.
I mean, the great opportunity of creating a European capital market, a deep and liquid capital market, is made much more difficult because London was certainly the best candidate where to locate this market. Not having London, having to recreate in the continent will be much more complicated, I think. So we're all looking. I mean, the incredible thing is that it's 1 year from now and we don't know how this agreement will be made. We don't know what it will contain. We all hope. And, you know, hope is not necessarily a good strategy, because when you get into the
it's
details...
It's not a strategy.
but that's, you know, a lot of people in the UK saying, you know, we haven't seen the effects yet, because we're all hoping that there will be no effects. But my impression is that it's very difficult to replicate the regulations and the concept of the internal market by being outside. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult. I think we're going to realize this in the coming months, that it's going to be very difficult to keep the relationships with the UK unchanged while the UK is outside. If you don't accept the European Court of Justice, if you don't accept free movement, equivalence is not the same as mutual recognition, yeah, so on and so forth.
That's been a British proposal on financial services to make the rules equivalent, but not actually the...
Yes, but then who recognizes the equivalence? That's the point. Mm. So we are trying to design something which looks like what we are abandoning, but is different. And, you know, it's kind of a different equation to solve. We'll see. Let's hope that we can make it.
We'll leave it there. My guests, Lorenzo Bini-Smargi, chair of the French bank Société Générale, Matt Regan, senior vice president and head of Europe for the Danish pharmaceutical company Novo Nordisk, and Theo Murasan, chair of Romania's Electro Group Infrastructure. Thank you to them. Thank you to all our guests for the last hour, because that's it for this special programme. This was meant to be the hour that steered us away from Brexit to look at the future of the rest of the EU. We haven't entirely managed to avoid the B word, but I think what has come across, though, is the sense that it's not just the UK that's making some fundamental decisions about itself at the moment. Consciously, or sometimes unconsciously, Europe is doing the same. From David and from myself, good night. Thank you for listening. The programme was produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Leslie McAlpine. Do keep listening to regular editions of The Bottom Line and The Briefing Room.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.